If you're going to build a really big organization, if you're going to build something lasting and significant, you have to do it as a team. And that means your vision has to be big enough to include the hopes and dreams of everybody that you're going to ask to participate in. There's got to be something in it for them.
Welcome to Hitting the Ceiling, the show for entrepreneurs and leaders who refuse to let a ceiling become the end of their story. Mike Mortensen walked into Alaska Rubber and Supply in 1994 as a college kid who needed a job after asking his future wife to marry him. He started that afternoon as the delivery driver in a 12-person, single-location Anchorage distributor. Over the next 32 years, he worked through nearly every part of the business, helped lead the 2006 employee buyout that created the ESOP, and eventually became president and CEO. The real ceiling came before he had the top job. The company had grown beyond its original size, but it was still operating with a very flat structure, fractured processes, multiple trade names, and too little support behind the branches. The current tension is that ARG has now built the leadership and digital infrastructure for a larger company than it is today. So Mike is leading the business through the pressure of growing into what has already prepared itself to become. Mike, welcome to Hitting the Ceiling.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. It's an honor to be here. Appreciate the time.
For more than 25 years inside of ARG, you hit a ceiling that almost made you walk away. What happened at that point where leaving started to feel more possible than staying?
Based on the information you give, I kind of grew up here in this company. I didn't know that this is what I was going to do when I hired on. I really, like you said, I needed a job. I'd asked a young woman to marry me, and I was excited about our future. And I had to get some things put in place. And so when I hired on, I kind of thought that this was going to be a temporary gig. And man, it was such a cool company, and our customers really depended on us, and we did cool things. And I found that there was a skill set that was required to operate in this industry and to serve the products that we did that I was able to really grasp onto. And I probably, for the first time in my life, I felt like I was a professional. And it wasn't too long into my career where I realized, maybe 3 or 4 years, where I realized, wow, like, this is a skill set that I could really do something with. And we were a small little scrappy company that had absentee ownership way up in Alaska. And so we kind of felt like we owned it anyway, and we were doing our own thing. And I really grew to love the company. And as you said later in your intro, we became an employee owned company, and that really cemented the value that I thought would need to be there for me long term. The leadership of the company seemed open to growth and new ideas, and we were really growing. But to your question, when did leaving seem like an option? And I don't ever know that I felt that it wanted to be an option, but it had gotten to the point where I felt like the leadership of the company, the dream or the vision that they had for the company, just wasn't big enough for me anymore. And I knew that if it wasn't big enough for me, that was a bunch of other people that it would be leaving out. And we had to grow. We had to step into that new kind of paradigm, which would have meant a whole lot of change. And I think the former leadership wasn't prepared for that. And I'm grateful that the board made a decision to put me in that role and allow us to kind of get through that ceiling that we had hit onto the next level of our business.
And even when you were driving the delivery truck, you knew that the business could be much bigger than it was, right? Just as you said, it had the potential to grow. What do you think was it specifically that you could see from the seat that you were in that the current leadership couldn't see yet?
And I don't know. I'm sure that there was some internal things about me and what I was hoping to have, for my life, that I maybe have been transferring onto the business. But like I said, we did cool things. We were building things that made industry run, and people counted on us. So the products that we sell here at ARG Industrial aren't necessarily the star of the show, but they are the supporting actors for every show. And so there's so many industries, it doesn't matter whether it's pharmaceuticals or construction or data centers where our products really are the connectors that keep everything moving. We were in this space where people trusted us. They counted on us. We were doing cool things. I was working with my hands and with my mind. And I could just see this is a great little business in kind of microculture, but wow, what if we could expand this out? How far could we go? I know that there's other people doing this. How are they doing it different? What could we learn? I really kind of had this vision from a very early day that if I was going to be involved in this, it had to be bigger, and I knew that it could.
In 2006, you helped lead the acquisition that ultimately turned into an employee-owned ESOP.
Yeah.
And I just love ESOPs generally. Gino Wickman, our founder, and I, we've both nerded out to the idea that these tens of thousands of companies who are running on EOS with an implementer would see the value of employee ownership. So how did employee ownership really change the emotional stakes of both your leadership and taking ownership of helping those customers that you're supporting day in and day out?
I really think that is the story of ARG Industrial, and it is the story of my career. I didn't know it at the time that was the direction that it was going to go, but I would probably look back. If I look back in my career, that was probably the first hitting of the ceiling. And I think it was, you know, a personal hitting of the ceiling for me and several of the other people in the company at that time. But it meant that the company hit the ceiling and we had to change. There was several of us that had been working in the business for, you know, more than a decade, and we had a lot of knowledge and we had the customer connections. And as I said before, our former owners were absentee, and you know, they'd come up once a year. They were well into their 70s, and this business wasn't part of their, you know, lifestyle or their income. And so we kind of felt like we owned it already, and we were doing our own thing. And we thought, wow, you know what? Maybe it's time that we go start our own company. Maybe we work for ourselves and build something for ourselves. And we went to the general manager and said, hey, you know, I think that this is what we're going to do. And I think at the time, and the way she tells the story, she felt like she needed us more than we needed her. And she had the connection with the owners. And so she went and proposed a sale. And we sat through several, kind of partnership meetings. And I think her and I quickly realized that while we enjoyed working with some of these people, we didn't know that we necessarily wanted to be married to them as business partners. And so we talked about a bunch of different, kind of iterations of what this could look like. And she, to her credit, came back with ESOP and had talked to a few people and kind of learned what the structure would need to be and how that would need to be put together to make that go. And we went back to the people that we were considering partnership with and discussed it. And it went. And that really was the genesis that allowed us to kind of transform and get to that next level. It really opened up opportunity long term for those of us that were building the company. I felt as a young person, I felt, man, at that time I was in my middle 30s and I was thinking, okay, I've got a young family and what am I doing? And, you know, I'm in this business, I'm making a living, but what's there going to be for me in the end? So that gave me the runway to really hook my cart to this. And it also opened up the door for everybody that worked for us to participate in that beneficial ownership, all the way from the delivery driver, the very brand newest employee, all the way up to the president and CEO of the company. At the time, we were only about 24 employees. We were a single location. And we did the deal and we kind of came in the next day and high-fived each other at the time clock and went right back to work. We, you know, it was not a lot changed, you know? And then we had all these questions about, okay, well, if I'm an owner now, do I get a raise? And how about a truck? And, you know, and we had to learn the difference between equity ownership and beneficial ownership and what we were building together and how we all got to participate in that. But I'm proud to say that, you know, we've been in ESOP for, this year will be our 20th year. And we've graduated retirees from our ESOP with seven-figure balances. And, as frontline blue-collar employees, that just doesn't happen everywhere. So it's a pretty special story. I think it's really informed our culture and how we take care of each other, which I really think is the culture, of our company. It really is felt not only by our employees, but by our customers and our manufacturing partners. They love working with us because we're so engaged, you know, at every level of engagement, they're working with an owner that has that mentality and is thinking about that long-term relationship. It's not just a transactional day-to-day thing. We're building relationships for the long run. So I would say that's, you know, that was the first hitting of the ceiling and really sparked something that we've grabbed onto and leveraged throughout the last 20 years.
Why do you think so many companies shy away from an ESOP?
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, ESOP's not a magic bullet to fix everything that's wrong with the company, and it doesn't make bad employees great employees. but it is definitely a force multiplier, and what we feel is some secret sauce, not only in our success, but in our culture and how we go to market. But, you know, to the question of why people don't do it that otherwise could, this is my personal belief, but if you're going to build a really big organization, if you're going to build something lasting and significant, you have to do it as a team. And that means your vision has to be big enough to include the hopes and dreams of everybody that you're going to ask to participate in. There's got to be something in it for them. And most equity owners, and it's their right, and God bless them, but they build their business based upon their dream and what they need and what fits them. And I think whenever we're just focused on what's in it for us, it's a limiting belief, right? I don't think that most people really have the ability to ask as much for themselves as life is willing to give. And so we kind of carve this niche out, you know, when I get my house or my second house or my boat or my plane, or, you know, when I've got X amount of number in the bank, then the business is big enough. And then I'm just going to let it just kind of chunk along and do whatever it needs to do. And that's fine. That's an owner's prerogative. And there's been many successful businesses, small and very large, that have done just that. But I think in an ESOP, I'm not thinking about just what's in it for me. I'm thinking about all of the 250 plus employees that we have and their families and what's in it for them and what their dreams are and what they need. And so it's got to be big. It's got to be able to scale. It's got to have longevity and legacy. And it's got to go beyond what I want out of this. And the leaders that are beside me that are leading this business, it's got to be bigger than the dreams that they have for it. And it's in that way, it's kind of evergreen. We're bringing people in and they're bringing ideas and they're like, well, why are we satisfied with it like this? Why can't it be like this? And that's really what I wanted as a young kid in this business, is like somebody to listen and say, well, why does it have to be like this? Can't it be like that? Can we go to that next step? Can we get a little bigger? Can we do it a little better? And I was really fortunate. I had a boss that allowed me a lot of reins to have that say so, until we kind of got to a point where the business had filled the shape of her dream, and then it was enough. And there wasn't a whole lot of willingness to stretch beyond that, right? And so we went back to the team, to the board, and said, hey, what are we going to do? Are we going to stay here? Are we going to go forward? And I'm really fortunate that the board chose to go forward, and that's where we are today. And since that time in 2021, we've made some big moves, and we've grown significantly, not just in our geographical footprint and our revenue numbers and everything like that, but just kind of how we are as a business and how we approach things. EOS was a big part of that, and kind of is keeping us on the tracks going towards where we want to go. So it's been a fantastic experience, but it's the ability to see beyond your own personal desires for whatever you're doing and include the hopes and dreams of all the people that you're asking to do it with you. I think that's the difference.
It's just a beautiful thing when you can impact that many people inside the company. Now, at some point, you changed the name of the business. It wasn't just in Alaska anymore. It wasn't just rubber. Thinking about legacy and that historical aspects of the business name, was there any grief in letting go of a name that carried so much history before you took over?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And I don't know that there wasn't grief, but we knew we had to work through it, right? Just we knew we had to work a process. And so like when I joined the company in 94, the name of the company that I was hired to was Alaska Rubber and Supply. Right. And so very, very descriptive. This is what we do. Although people didn't know that we sold hose and fittings, they thought we sold tires and, you know, but that was the name of the company. And our first acquisition was a company called, Alaska Interior Rubber. And then right before the acquisition, they changed their name to Alaska Rubber and Rigging. Right. So we bought we were Alaska Rubber and Supply, and we bought a company called Alaska Rubber and Rigging. And so so, you know, we're kind of 60-40 mix. We're hose and fittings industry, and we're also the lifting and rigging industry. And so we've got two different kind of industrial swim lanes we operate in. And so, you know, at the time we thought, okay, what do we do? What do we do with that? You know, how about we become Alaska Rubber and Rigging Supply? And so that name came into existence. And then when I took over the company, my vision has always been one company. And we had expanded way outside of Alaska at that point. And we had done acquisitions purely in the rigging space. So we had bought in companies that didn't do hose at all. And they were just rigging companies. And, you know, we needed to do something with that. We could no longer go on as the Alaska Rubber Group. We had spent a ton of time and money investing in our digital footprint. So our website, e-commerce, the whole nine yards. You know, how are we going to represent nine subsidiary trade names in one e-commerce platform? And so the time came in 2023 that we knew that we had to rebrand. And so we went, you know, we talked, and there was a lot of hand-wringing, and there was like, what are we going to do? And we came up with ARG Industrial. And that seemed to still pay homage to kind of where we came from with the Alaska Rubber Group. But it didn't specifically use the name Alaska Rubber, and it let people know what we do. We're an industrial supply company. So that's who we're branded of for today. You never know. We may hit a ceiling with that at some point and have to pivot, but it's serving us well right now. We've got, you know, 13 locations and almost 250 people, and we're all wearing the same logo on our shirt, and it's really brought us together. And for any grief that we had over legacy trade names, the benefit has been far sweeter on the other side.
And it's just a great simplification of what it is that you're doing, right? You don't have to manage as much stuff. The website's easier. The way you think about things are easier. It's just a great example of a great simplification. Now, you mentioned digital properties and websites and things like that. And of course, now these days, everybody's talking about AI, and, you know, you're an industrial company and a long-lived industrial company. How are you thinking about technology? How are you thinking about AI? How do you transform this employee-owned business to continue growing using that technology? Or maybe it doesn't have any impact on you at all.
Yeah, well, you know, it has significant impact in it, and it's really been impacting all of our lives and business in general for a lot longer than I think that, you know, we think. You know, currently the buzzword, and everybody's talking about AI, and I shouldn't even say buzzword. It's moved into actual, you know, tangible assets and things that are moving companies forward. But we've been thinking about technology for a long time. You know, I can go all the way back to about 2014, 15. I knew that we had to have a website. You know, this is before we had really gotten as big as we are today, but we were growing. We were serving customers in a lot of different markets. Alaska is huge. Just most people don't realize that, you know, if you cut Alaska in half, Texas would still be the third largest state. And so we've got this massive geography and very few roads and everything. And a lot of people in the state of Alaska are remote. And so I knew we had to have 24/7 access to the products and services that we were providing, and that we needed a platform to be able to represent ourselves outside of our geography if we were going to grow. And so I had this whiteboard in my old office by the window, and I had written e-commerce on it in blue dry erase marker. This whiteboard was kind of rock list. Let's put it, that was my rocks, right? The things that I was working on before I even knew what rocks were. And that stinking e-commerce rock sat on that whiteboard so long that the sun faded it to like this really ugly greenish yellow color, right? Like I was,
so it was not a 90 day rock.
No, it was like a 4.5 year rock. And I was like really stuck on it, right? We had gone through having websites built and everything, but I had no idea how we were going to like build all the product detail to build out this website. And we had just gone through an ERP migration, and the sales guy that worked with me on the ERP migration, his name is Dan Banks, and he got us through the migration, and he came to Anchorage and said, "Hey, you know, I just want to let you know that I'm leaving this company and I'm going to work elsewhere." And I was like, "Oh, Dan, that's too bad. We're just kind of live now. We're going great." He's like, "Don't worry, you got support, you know." And I was like, "Okay, well, it's been great working with you. Where are you going?" He says, "Oh, I'm going to a company called Unilog." I said, "Unilog?" He goes, "Oh, well, we help distribution companies make the digital transformation." And I'm like, "Okay, whatever. Good luck with that," right? I have, in the meantime, I got e-commerce on my board right behind me. I'm not even connecting the dots. About a year and a half later, I'm sitting in a presentation by a guy named Dan Gunderson, and he was talking about distribution and the digital transformation. And about 5 minutes into this, I realize he's talking about e-commerce. And I'm getting excited. Like he's like pushing all the buttons, and I'm really enjoying it. So I decide to get up and walk out of the presentation. I call Dan and I'm saying, "Dan, I need to know everything you can tell me about this digital transformation deal. It sounds to me like e-commerce." And he's like, "Well, yeah, we help people with product information, and we build all that out for people." And so that was really the impetus, of getting involved in e-commerce. I knew that as a hoser, I needed somebody that was a tech guy. And so I went through a process of being introduced to different people, and I was just really trying to just figure out what a person in our company needed to be, or what task they needed to do to be a director of e-commerce. And I ran into a gentleman by the name of Mike Powers, and he was working for a large Jansan company and as their director of e-commerce. And I just wanted to pick his brain. And through the course of about 3.5 days of talking to him, we kind of realized we were cut out of the same cloth, and we were circling each other. There was gravity there. And he says, "Man, I think I'd be really interested in coming to work for you guys and helping you guys build this." And so we started our e-commerce platform. The e-commerce platform, led into a website that had 70,000 SKUs on that we could sell to our customers. But I knew that unless we could really represent that cool stuff that we did for our customers, the assembly work where we're taking products from multiple manufacturers and putting them together to make an assembly that does a job for a customer, unless we could represent on the website, we weren't across the finish line of the digital transformation that we'd been talking about. And so we started down the road of building a configuration tool. We built that configuration tool to allow customers to walk through a very easy process and kind of duplicate the sophisticated conversations that happen with our counter salespeople and our product application specialists in a digital way. And that tool spawned a software company called IntelliBuild. So, through that, we spawned a little software company that's now really going about changing how customers can access that process through industrial distributors and order assemblies of all kinds. Today, currently, we're using AI to build processes in our own environment. I think so many distributors live in the environment of ERP, and that's where they live. And I think that environment doesn't really serve the needs of of employees that work in digital, in industrial distribution. I don't think it serves the customers in the best way. And so I really think that AI is going to allow us to build tools that really transcend the ERP experience. And we're doing that now. We have people on our team that are using AI and that are vibe coding and that are building platforms that will run our business, in the future. And so I'm pretty excited about all those things. It used to be you had to go out and find a partner and pay a large engagement fee and pay annual fees to software companies for some tool that kind of sort of fits your business. But now we have the ability to build it so it exactly fits our business just like we want. And so some of the stuff that my tech team does right now is just blowing my mind. Really exciting stuff.
It's super exciting. And I think you nailed it there, because most often companies who are using off-the-shelf software, your business sort of gets bent towards whatever the software company is designed, and you miss out on all the uniqueness and differentiation that you could possibly have inside your own company. And the ability to vibe code something that creates a unique delivery mechanism, it creates differentiation that is not dictated by someone else, it's total freedom. I mean, it's freeing inside your business. Like, let's do it this way. We don't have to bend and mold our processes to fit something else and someone else's idea of what good is. We're going to do it our way. I think it's a huge thing that not too many people are identifying as an advantage. Like, we just sort of live with the fact that we live in these software boxes and now the boxes don't exist. And now look, what do we do with this? This is really good.
Yeah. And I mean, it's one thing to invest in a product. And even if it's a great product, and there's a lot of great products out there, don't get me wrong. Sure. It's one thing to invest in a product that you can use to move your business forward. It's a totally different game when you're investing in people that are developing talent that lives within your organization to move it forward, right? I mean, it's pretty powerful. I can't even describe the force multiplier that is against our competition. When we've got the tech team and the software builders in-house, and they have to go outside and vet and choose and pay and be one of 1,000 customers that needs their development team's help. It's a game changer. So I really think that is a ceiling that we recently broke through that's going to pay dividends for a long, long time.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a multiplier to your uniqueness and your differentiation. I think it's just a huge advantage. So tell me a little bit about two things. Number one, what's your 3-year picture? What do you look like? What does the business look like in 3 short years from now? And then what is your 10-year target? Then we're just going to go through the 5 leadership abilities, all 5 of them: simplify, delegate, predict, systemize, and structure. Just think about, what will you need to simplify? What will you need to delegate? What's your next best delegation? How are you going to predict better? How are you going to systemize the business to get to that 3-year picture, to that 10-year target?
And I'll speak in terms of like multiples of size rather than revenue numbers. That would probably, probably make more sense. But 3-year picture, we're a little more than 2x revenue size right now is what our current target is. We would like to have made acquisitions that would give us anywhere from 7 to 15 different new locations. We would like to have a footprint that puts us in all 5 major quadrants of the United States. So, Northwest, Southwest, Central, East Coast, those kind of quadrants. Obviously, automation is a big part of what we're doing. 10-year right now, and that's a moving target a little bit. I say when we first started EOS, our 10-year window was about a 10x revenue. We're about a 7.5x revenue from where we are now to our 10-year picture, with locations in every major metropolitan area. That's kind of a size range that we're looking at. We want to continue to expand within the 2 verticals that we're in, which is hose and fittings, fluid conveyance, and lifting and rigging supplies. We want to stay focused that way. We want to make sure that we have more than 30% of our revenue going through e-commerce. That's a 10-year goal for us right now. And obviously continue digital adoption and find ways that we can use technology to upskill our employees in every sense of the word. getting, you know, kind of the kind of the getting more for same, not getting more for less. I don't necessarily see technology as being things that help us replace people, but actually force multiplier people to allow us to do more with the people that we have.
Yeah. Love it. So when we think about that 3-year picture and thinking about the business and where you are, where you're hitting the ceiling, what are some areas that you think that you're going to need to simplify in order to achieve that 3-year picture?
Right now, I would say that our leadership team is really robust for the size of the company that we are. I tell our team that we have a leadership team that could handle 2x to 3x the revenue that we're currently bringing in. And so we're a little ahead of the curve on that. I think I've done a pretty good job at delegating out a lot of the different core functions that I held, you know, when we were a much smaller company, and that I felt that I had some talent at. We have, you know, director of marketing, and we have a director of purchasing, and a director of warehousing and logistics, and accounting and e-commerce. And we don't have one for sales right now. That's a ceiling that we hit that we can talk about later. But I've delegated a lot of those things out. We have somebody, you know, on our executive team that handles our digital vision. Right. Mike Powers now has graduated out of that director of e-commerce role that we originally brought him on for. And now he's our chief digital and technology officer. And he's really, you know, kind of co-owning that vision with me of what technology does for our company going forward. And I've got somebody on my executive team that handles all of our growth strategy and integration. And so I've, you know, I was able to learn through kind of my, you know, job as a delivery driver at an industrial supply company. I learned business and finance and mergers and acquisitions. And so I've handed all that off to Kristen on our executive team, who now is out pursuing growth through mergers and acquisitions and targeted greenfield locations. And so there's a whole lot that I've delegated. I think right now what we're really working on is kind of that second level leadership that we have, and really trying to elevate them and our branch leadership, to kind of get our branch leadership out of the running the store mode into running the business mode. And so we do that through really thoughtful succession management, and putting accountability and authority at almost every level of the business, and making sure that we don't have areas where people feel like they're just showing up and waiting to be told what to do. We want everybody feeling like they're engaged and they have an equal amount of authority for the responsibility that they're given, and that we're pushing that leadership mentality as far down in the business as we can, as to oppose just having a management mentality.
I mean, you hit on almost all the 5 leadership abilities there with delegation and the right structure. We talked about systemizing with your digital transformation and getting those systems and processes, getting more, you know, with less, getting more out of the people and the systems and the processes instead of less out of it. Long-term prediction, you got a really big vision. How's the team doing with solving issues day in and day out? Doing mergers and acquisitions can create a lot of complexity.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, once you have a new company coming in, now you got to figure out integration. What are you going to keep? What's the balance of power? Is the culture going to fit? Do these new people share core values? And maybe you're doing that work before you make the acquisition or not. But how are you thinking about that, handling that complexity? How are you thinking about making sure, as you both grow organically and inorganically, that you keep things simple, you keep focused and growing?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? And mergers and acquisitions seem to be opportunistic. And so sometimes things pop up and they change the plan a little bit. But I think we've been pretty thoughtful about who we are and what we want to be. Historically, we were a little bit more rigid than we are now. It had to fit a very certain box, and we wanted to avoid all risk. And I think we've learned a few things through acquisitions that none of them are perfect. There's usually a lot more integration than you planned for. But in the end of the day, if you don't jump, you're never in the game, you know? And so I think at this point now, when we think about acquisitions, we're a little bit more open to what that will mean for the change of our company, in that, like, we may have to operate different. There's probably going to be some new faces at the table, and we need to open up and realize that there are other very talented, intelligent people out there that have built great businesses that may be able to add to what we've already got and what we've already built. You know, early on, it was kind of like, no, this is the way we were doing it. It was a very small kind of brain trust. And in fact, you know, in the first 25 years of my career, it was a very flat structure, right? It was our CEO, me, and then all the branch managers, right? That was the structure of our business. And now we've built a business that has leaders at every level, multiple touch points, all the way down to the branch managers. And so we've kind of realized that we opened the door. And we've got a lot of people came in. Some of them were homegrown, a lot of them were homegrown. A lot of them grew up in the business like me, but a lot of them have come from the outside too and have brought experience and knowledge from other industries and other businesses. And it's just made us that much better. So as far as how do we make sure that we stay who we want to be, we focus pretty intensely on our core values and our mission and our vision and who we are as a company. And we want to stay focused in the products and services that we serve in the market. I mean, the tendency in industrial supply is, hey, you do a great job at this. Can you supply this? Can you get that? Can you do that? And you know, it's hard because that's a little bit, you know, in our DNA. You know, being up here in Alaska, we're like kind of at the end of the road when it comes to distribution. And so, you know, you cross a lot of different distribution lanes than the normal company would maybe in a more crowded competitive market. But I think we need to stay focused on who we are and what we do well. And as long as we're aligning, with that and our core values and our vision of building an ESOP company where everybody can take part, and that it will continue on and build a legacy, I think we'll do just fine.
Well, Mike, I enjoyed our conversation. This has been great, but before we go, and I want you to do a little bit of time travel. So if you could go talk back to that college kid walking into Alaska Rubber and Supply, and right before he walks in, he bumps into you. What's the one piece of advice you would give him?
That life is long and you're going to make a lot of mistakes. Focus less on the mistakes and what you learn in the process. Not everything is going to happen today. And the things that you're doing today, the next right move that you make is laying the foundation for who you will be and what you will have in your life decades from now. I would tell them that there's three ways to get paid. One of them is what you're going to be used to focusing on. And that's the amount of money that shows up in your paycheck every 2 weeks. But there's other two ways of getting paid. Number two is what you learn in the process. The skill sets that you develop. And number three is what you learn about yourself, that you can do hard things, that you can overcome, that you can have pride in the work that you do and the things that you accomplish. And so number three is who you're becoming. And number two and number three don't spend. And so I would spend a lot more time focused on that than being focused on the dollar that you're making in your paycheck today. If you focus on the second two things, the money part takes care of itself.
Mike, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mark. It was great.
If this conversation gave you something to think about, I'd love to keep that going. I write a newsletter called Clarity Break Thoughts, where I share simple ideas, questions, and reminders to help you step back, think clearly, and lead with more intention. You can subscribe at eosworldwide.com/claritybreakthoughts. Again, that's eosworldwide.com/claritybreakthoughts.